Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from June 24th to June 30th. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So I didn't include this in the newsletter, but a bit of personal news on my behalf. A couple of hours ago, I announced that I'm joining Set Protocol, the DeFi project for basketized assets. You'll remember that I did a blog post on them, I think it was a week ago now, describing how it all works. So I'll be joining them and leading their marketing and growth efforts. So it's a big move for me. It's quite a big move because I'll be working from home now instead of from an office at my current job. They're based in San Francisco, so there's a bit of a time difference there, of course, but they were more than generous and, you know, kind of saying they're happy for me to work from home down in Melbourne, of course, and, you know, getting me all set up and everything. And so it's really, really exciting. Honestly, it's what you and I have kind of worked towards, Eric, for a few months now, you know, with launching ETHub and kind of being active on Twitter and everything. We wanted to both break into it. So now we're both in crypto full time, and we can, we can even dedicate more time to ETHub now as well, since I don't have a day job. So yeah, I think this is just positive all around for both ETHub and obviously myself. So yeah, it's just really exciting. If you want to talk about Set, definitely reach out to me. I'll be kind of leading all that sort of stuff, and you'll be hearing a lot more about the project from me on Twitter and everywhere else.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Huge congrats, first of all. I guess I've known for a couple of days before people, so I won't act like I'm too shocked to hear it right now. But I mean, just huge for you to get in the space full time. I mean, it's what we're both extremely passionate about. So it's kind of like a dream to be able to work on what you're passionate about, right? And, you know, one of the cool things is with me joining Gnosis and you joining Set, and people have kind of asked us this, like, are you going to be able to keep doing ETHub? Both teams have been really receptive to us, you know, in our free time, continuing to do ETHub and the podcast. And they see it as very important work for the ecosystem in general. So that's definitely really cool. So nothing will change there. It's just that I guess you and I get to enjoy our full-time work in a space we're passionate about, which is great. And, you know, I've been a fan of Set even before I met you. So huge fan of that team and project, and that's going to be a good gig.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, as you said, I was a huge fan of the team as well before joining. They've been great. We've spoken about them many times on the podcast before. So yeah, actually breaking into it and working, you know, within DeFi, especially for me, as I, you know, obviously I'm a big DeFi proponent. We kind of both are. It's just, I think for me personally, it just felt like everything, you know, fell into place, and I'm exactly where I need to be after, you know, so many months of wanting to break in. So yeah, exciting times. And I guess I'll stop rambling and move on to the news now.
Well, I do. I have one question for you. 2 weeks ago, you called me the Gnosis shill, so I get to call you the Set shill now.
Yeah, I think so.
It's only fair.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, cool. So I guess that's not the biggest, that's not only the only big news, sorry, that that came out this week. The other big news that came out just a couple days ago was that the ETH 2.0 Phase 0 spec has now been frozen. Now, for those who don't know what that means, it basically means that the researchers have said that this is the spec, this is the final spec that's going to be what, you know, Phase 0 looks like, so that the client implementers, the developers such as, you know, Prismatic Labs, Sigma Prime, and all the other teams building ETH2 clients can work off this spec without it kind of changing every day. So it makes their lives a lot easier. It makes makes it so that we can start working towards multi-client test nets. We can do a lot more testing for the ETH2 clients and things like that. So obviously we knew that date was coming for quite a while, that it was going to be June 30th, but there was a little bit of rumors around it maybe getting delayed and things like that, because you can never kind of plan these things in software development. But it did go through, but kind of a last minute thing where, it was frozen. And yeah, going forward, I'm looking forward to seeing the multi-client testnets come on board and all the testing done around that. There was a tentative date kind of given for a mainnet launch of the Phase 0 beacon chain of January 3rd, 2020. But that was kind of like very tentative, and a lot of the client teams kind of disagreed with that date, saying that it's not enough time to get it all done. So I'm not holding anyone to that date, and I think that it may get pushed back. If not, great, but I'm happy for them to push it back, because as we know, we need to be, this is kind of mission critical software. So we need to be sure that it's going to work as intended and there's not going to be any bugs, especially since people are going to be locking ETH on the Beacon chain to stake, for quite a while.
Like we said last week, it's good to have deadlines, right? Like that's definitely tentative. And Justin just kind of threw that out there, Justin Drake, on one of the implementer calls. And it's definitely got a little bit of pushback, but he said he had like kind of pulled three teams and their confidence of, I think he said being done around that date. It's kind of funny. He got very varied response. I think like one team said 3 out of 10. Although I think their reasoning they said was because they weren't sure if the spec was going to freeze soon, which has now been done. I believe another team said like 6 to 7 and someone said 9. So the answers are kind of all over the board, but definitely seemed to be some celebration from the teams actually, now building the spec and implementing it into clients, all the ETH2 teams. I believe there's 9 of them. Now we have a page on ETH Hub that kind of lists them all out and everything and who's doing it and how they're funded. But definitely celebration from those teams, because they know that, they're not going to code something up on the implementation side and then the spec changes and they've got to go rebuild all that, right? I've seen that kind of frustration on Twitter and online from teams that stuff just was changing so fast that they spent more time kind of rebuilding stuff, which is understandable, right? Like the spec has to change and the research is going to change, but now we've kind of frozen that research period, and now we can put the teams building can put the final touches on implementing. And then the step after that, yeah, is obviously we have testnets up now. Then we need cross-client testnets. Then we need to, create and go through a lot of test suites. And then I'm sure we'll get kind of like an alpha version of this cross-client network, and then eventually it goes live and the Beacon chain's there and people can start staking if they want to. I had put out a Twitter poll a couple of days ago, how much of your ETH stash do you plan to stake during phase zero? Because one of the tricky things with phase zero is it's a one-way bridge. So once you send your ether over and start staking on the Beacon chain in phase zero, your ETH's there and you can't actually move it till phase two. So that's, you don't really know, right? Like my guess would be somewhere between a year or 2 years for that to happen. But because of that, you're going to be gaining a lot of interest on your ETH if you want to risk that. My guess is somewhere near probably 8 to 12% or so. And I had put out a poll, how much ETH you want to stake? None, some, all, or see results on the poll, which is a necessary thing to put on Twitter polls, so you'll get inaccurate results. The majority of people said some, I think 80% said some, and then I believe only 20% said all. So it'll be interesting to see. I think most people, I would assume, if they're interested in staking all their ether eventually, are probably going to stake like 25 to 50% or something like that in phase zero, because the returns are going to be high enough. So if you're a long-term holder that, has faith that this is going to happen, even if it's going to take 2 or 3 years and you're just sitting on your stash, like that's an amazing amount of interest accumulation, right? So super excited the spec's frozen. I feel like this is a big milestone, and next will become just the launch of the mainnet.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm firmly in the some camp, but I think most people should be, to be honest, considering, obviously, as you explained, that the ETH's going to be locked for quite a while, and there is that risk of there being a bug and stuff gets, frozen or there's hacks or whatever, like something like that. So I think for me, I might start with kind of one validator with, the 32 ETH, and then slowly add more as time goes on. Like, it's okay. I'm okay missing out on some of the rewards. It's not a huge deal to me. I'd rather miss out on some rewards than lose some ETH, but I definitely have full confidence in the team that they're going to, kind of cross all the T's and dot the I's and do all the proper due diligence to make sure that, no hacks happen. But of course, you can never be 100% certain. So yeah, I do kind of recommend to people that not to put their whole stack into kind of the Beacon chain on launch and wait for a little bit. I guess that's why the reward's going to be high as well, right? So it's, high risk, high reward sort of thing. So yeah, I'm curious to see how many people do or how much ETH is staked at the start or the first couple of weeks. There's been estimates, I think, of people think maybe about 1 million ETH will be staked at that point. I think there is definitely a minimum stake that needs to be put up as well. I can't remember the exact number, but there's a minimum amount of validators and a stake that needs to be kind of put up before the Beacon chain to kick in and to go live. So I think we'll meet the minimum. I'm just not sure how much ETH will be staked for the first few weeks, considering that the risk is quite high.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting game of chicken, right? Like, who wants to go first and see if it actually works or if someone discovers a bug or something? I mean, there's definitely large game theoretical things at play here. Like, if, say, 2 million Ethers staked and there's hundreds or thousands of people that sent it over and all of a sudden there's a problem, this would probably be the most likely thing that would be forked or fixed, because it would have, a huge impact on the network and kind of, the long-term sustainability and belief in this. So, I don't think that's going to happen, but, there is some sense, at least to me personally, and I know this would be a very hotly debated topic, I'm sure, but there's a little bit of sense of security in sending over. And if something were to go wrong, my bet would be on some type of fork or fix being implemented. But hopefully we'd never have to cross that bridge.
Yeah, I really, really hope that never happens, because, we survived the DAO. I wasn't around back then, but I've heard the horror stories. I wouldn't want to live through that. That's for sure. All right, cool. So on to project updates. I guess that was a bit of a project update, but I've chucked it into the news category. Project updates. So bit of an unfortunate bit of news this week from Austin Griffith. Everyone would know him from the Burner Wallet, and he's been working with Gitcoin for quite some time now. But he basically announced this week that he and Gitcoin announced a kind of mutual understanding that Austin would transition out of Gitcoin because Gitcoin's doubling down on their core products, and Austin obviously wants to pursue more research and development in the kind of user onboarding space with, the Burner Wallet and other things like that. Very sad to see him go from this team. He's one of the best builders in the space, if not the best. He just ships stuff like nothing else, right? And he's such a good community guy. He's always interacting with people, building stuff people use. I mean, the Burner Wallet's been used at a few big Ethereum events, obviously ETH Denver being the major one. It's gotten a lot of traction. So I think any team that scoops up Austin's going to be, very, very, very lucky to have him. I don't think he's going to stay I wouldn't even call it unemployed, but I don't think he's going to stay free for long. Let's put it that way. I think this kind of opens up a bit of a bigger kind of concern about or question about, like, we need to do better at allocating, the talent and the builders that we have to various projects. I think what goes a long way in this is allowing people to do more remote work. I know there are a lot of teams who want to obviously build their culture within their team, especially if they're a startup. They want everyone in the same space. Nothing really replaces real life. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of people, and I'm speaking from personal experience here, there's a lot of people that don't have the luxury of being in those places and that are actually very far away. Like, I'm on the extreme end of the spectrum where I'm in Australia. There's not much happening here in the crypto space, and I have to kind of work remote. And like, relocation is a whole, messy thing, especially going to somewhere like America where getting a visa seems to be very hard and, cost of living is going through the roof and things like that. So I think that crypto is better than most other industries in terms of allowing remote work. But I think that in terms of allocating talent and builders to the right projects, more companies are just going to have to let people work remotely. It's just the way it is. So, obviously I've been very lucky, and so have you, Eric, with the two teams that we've joined, allowing us to work remotely. But for me, especially considering that there's a 17-hour time difference between me and San Francisco, so like I'm 17 hours ahead, which means there isn't much overlap during core business hours. But at the end of the day, a lot of these kind of, I guess, startups within crypto work odd hours anyway, which actually works quite well. So I definitely hope to see more companies embracing this, because I know Austin was working remotely for Gitcoin. He's always in his little office in his videos as well. So hopefully we see more of this, come to fruition and more remote work become more prevalent.
I'm pretty sure I have the world time zones memorized by now, what countries in each one between. I mean, not only you and I having to coordinate stuff, but all the different podcasts and people we talk to in the space. It's amazing how, worldwide and remote everything has become. I mean, obviously, huge fan of Austin. We've had him on the podcast. We've talked to him a lot. He builds amazing things. Just the other day, he was doing a really cool project for the Burner Wallet with Gnosis Safe. And, we were talking about that at Gnosis. So definitely one of the most talented people and best builders in the space. I mean, I'm sure he's going to get picked up by a team, right? It definitely brings up some interesting things. I mean, it reminds you that, you know, there aren't that many teams still like kind of monetizing their products. So like the funds to go around from, you know, some of these Ethereum projects are pretty thin, like the payrolls and the people that are on the team, like there's not that many people. Right. So hopefully, you know, as we kind of, or seems to be going through a new bull run here and DeFi is finding a little bit better product market fit. And, you know, I think other products are going to start to find product market fit. And once scaling comes and proof of stake's there, it's going to really bring in more people and more of the masses to Ethereum, because we're going to have more capacity on the network. Some of these projects can start to be monetized more, and then that can kind of open up funding for talent. But again, I find it hard to believe that Austin's not going to get picked up by one of these projects soon. And I'm sure he knows that as well. But, you know, it also, to your point about, yeah, I totally agree. Like in crypto, you almost have to have remote hiring, because it's still such a niche like market, and so few people have like the knowledge of everything that we have, right? Like just not many people are interested in crypto in general, let alone know a lot about Ethereum or know how to build on Ethereum or have experience in Ethereum. So it's hard to kind of like pigeonhole yourself to one area, like maybe besides San Francisco, but even then, or like Berlin, perhaps kind of to Singapore, some of the hotbeds for crypto. But, you know, even there, I do think teams are realizing that they have to like reach out remotely to hire talent too. And I don't think that's going to change. It probably will never change in crypto, because it's such a remote industry in general. But even to be able to like fully build out the team you want in the city you're in is going to be years away, because just not that many people have the skill set yet.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important point, right? You know, crypto in terms of like, you know, if you're in the industry, it feels like that we have a lot of people involved and it's growing every day. And it is, but, you know, at the end of the day, 99.9% of the world still has no idea what any of this stuff is. They don't use it. They don't interact with it at all. You know, crypto to everyone else is just Bitcoin at the end of the day. Like when I told my current coworkers that I was moving into a kind of a crypto project, like they had no idea what Ethereum was. They were just like, oh, is that Bitcoin thing? You know? So, you know, a couple of them knew because I'd spoken to them about it before, but, you know, trying to explain, I guess, what Set Protocol kind of was and you know, what DeFi is. And, you know, there's so many prerequisite knowledge you need to know to understand what these projects are really doing. So I think that we're going to need to obviously mature a lot more there, and then we'll get, you know, more users in. There's obviously a lot of people trying to work on this. It's just finding that kind of, I guess, killer app, you know, such a cliche thing to say these days, but it's definitely rings true, especially for crypto, considering that most people only come into this industry due to the speculation and due to price rise. We've spoken about this in the past, obviously. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, more people come in for, I mean, I wouldn't say the right reasons, but for like the reasons of they want to use the products that we've built for them, not they want to get rich sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything depends on like where price goes, and then that creates new speculative waves, which, you know, not everybody that comes in to a speculative rise is going to stay around, right? But, you know, you do retain some people, and that's new mind share. I mean, like perfect example is eventually we would want to, you know, have some full-time employees potentially on ETH Hub. But like right now with like we're self-funding it and we have some donations in our address, obviously, which have been growing with price, and we'd feel more and more comfortable if price were to like 10 times from here or something. And, you know, even just a lot of our revenue in the future would be based off like hits on our site and be able to do ads on the podcast or newsletter or whatever. It all depends on, you know, the industry growing, and it's very similar for all other projects out there.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a perfect point, especially obviously projects that have, you know, their treasuries denominated in ETH because they raised via ICO or something like that. And even the Ethereum Foundation, right? They have, last time I checked on Etherscan, it was about 600,000 ETH. This recent price rise has given them a lot more money to play with. You know, we were at $80. That was worth, I think, whatever it was worth. I can't do the math in my head, but now it's worth, you know, almost kind of three times that, and, you know, they just got three times the amount of money from a simple price rise in ETH. So yeah, definitely don't think speculation, you know, is a bad thing or anything. We need that, and we'll get more talent that way. But I'm wondering how we get talent, you know, outside of that, of course, and how we get, you know, more people using these products without even realizing that they're using crypto. All right, moving on to the next update. So we had a few updates from Maker this week around multicollateral DAI. Pretty exciting updates, actually. So they basically announced that they're in the late stages of deployment to mainnet. So they're just doing the final kind of checks on, I guess, everything that needs to go right to launch Multilateral DAI to mainnet. It's this is going to be the biggest launch since they launched the kind of the app. The DAP, I guess. Back in December of 2017, and this is a huge undertaking. You know, Multilateral DAI is this whole thing where there's a few people that think it's a great thing. People that think it's kind of a bearish thing. Because it overcomplicates things. I mean, Anti-Pro Synthesis on Twitter threw out an unpopular opinion this week that turned out to be a very popular opinion that Maker's Multilateral DAI is kind of a complexity mess. And, you know, I kind of see that point as well. It adds a lot of overhead to things. It muddies the waters in a few different ways. But I think there's a lot of positives to it as well. We obviously get the DAI savings rate that comes with it that acts as another lever to use to balance the DAI peg. And so we don't have to keep raising the stability fee as has been tradition. And then we've got obviously more collateral options, which Maker actually announced the first bout of assets that are going to be considered for collateral options on Multilateral DAI. So Maker token holders can vote on these as well. They basically have like a basket of the ETH maximalist kind of, I guess, set, if you were to set. I'm already shilling. If you were to, choose a bunch of ETH projects that you'd want. So there's REP, BAT, DGD, ETH, GNT, OMG, and 0x. So these are all like original Ethereum kind of maximalist projects, if you will, where they've basically been on Ethereum for quite a while, been around for quite a while. They've got a bit of liquidity behind them. Their products are live and everything like that. I'm not sure what's going to happen here. I mean, if you just look at the ones that are on Coinbase, for example, they have, the most liquidity. I think those are going to be ones that get added first by the Maker token holders. It's in their best interest to add things that don't have low liquidity. I don't think DGD has much liquidity, so I doubt that would get added because, it just complicates everything. So I guess this is really cool to see. It's happening. We're going to see how it all plays out. This is the biggest experiment in crypto, I think, that I've seen. It's so many moving parts, so much complex stuff. Like single collateral DAI is already very complex. So to go to the multi-collateral route is going to be very interesting to see. The Maker team has a lot of work cut out for them, and so does the community as well. Organizing different kind of community calls and governance, calls around this and trying to keep track of it all is going to be very, very interesting to see. So I'm cautiously optimistic that it'll kind of work the way we want it to work. But at the same time, it does add all that complexity, which kind of makes me a little bit bearish on it in the short term.
Yeah, it adds a lot of interesting risk management risk. I guess that's a phrase, risk management risk, or I guess it would just be risk management to the system. And it's a very complex topic. And, in a previous job, I worked in interest rate risk for banks. And, it's not an easy thing to kind of determine what the risk to like movements and rates and liquidity and all that stuff is. And that's basically what Multilateral DAI is adding. I definitely think the Maker governance token holders will be cautious of what is added. Cause to your point, like DGD, I can't imagine there's much liquidity there at all. Right. Even like GNT and OMG, like they're still pretty low in liquidity. So you don't want to add a coin, that has, someone has a really like large CDP open and they get liquidated and there's not even enough people to kind of pick up that being dumped on the market. So obviously the fees could be a lot higher on those things and that's how it'll be managed. We've talked about this in the past. I've shared that I'm cautiously optimistic on this idea. I'm not too bullish on it in general because of what I just stated. I'm very bullish on what you mentioned with the DAI savings rate because that's kind of a balance for the stability fee, which will be really nice and just kind of a cool feature in general, the DAI savings rate. But as far as like the multi-collateral DAI, I mean, I guess I personally don't have any interest in like opening a CDP with other tokens. I would just prefer to do it in ETH. I know there's large holders out there, these other tokens. I just don't know like how much is going to get used versus ETH. It'll be interesting to watch play out on a couple of fronts, the usage of it versus ETH and, also how the Maker governance holders kind of determine all these thresholds and levers and kind of how the first large liquidation's handled.
Yeah, exactly. I was just looking at the liquidity while you were kind of talking there on CoinMarketCap. CoinMarketCap's known for like having a lot of, I guess, fake volume on there. So I wouldn't really take it as gospel. But basically, yeah, most of these tokens don't have much liquidity. I mean, 0x has, over the last 24 hours, it claims to have almost $20 million, but most of that is on these fake exchanges or, you know, fake volume exchanges. The only real ones that I can see is Binance here, which has 1.6 million against BTC, Coinbase Pro, which has, you know, a million against USD. This is just nothing compared to what ETH has in terms of volume and liquidity, right? It's just, it's quite ridiculous how low liquidity these tokens are. So I definitely think we're going to see that ETH remains the dominant card rule for quite a while. And, you know, it's probably going to remain the dominant card rule forever. If I don't ever imagine that these tokens are going to get that, you know, enough liquidity to match ETH or even come close to ETH. So it'll be very dangerous for the Maker token holders to basically say, yeah, we'll allow you to open CDPs with these tokens at 150% collateralization ratio. We've already seen that, you know, there's big liquidations that can happen because people play hard and fast. You know, shout out to 32228, of course. And as you said, there wouldn't be kind of enough to cover this. So it would cause, you know, just a whole mess. So yeah, definitely don't think ETH's dominance there is going to be properly challenged for quite a while. All right, moving on. So the talk of the, I guess, crypto town this week, and especially in the Ethereum space, was the launch of a new kind of DeFi product called Pool Together. So this is basically a no-loss lottery that uses DAI and Compound. So it's actually really cool. So basically what happens is you put DAI into this, into this no-loss lottery smart contract. That DAI gets deployed to Compound, so lent out to Compound. And then it obviously earns interest by doing that. And then the winner of this lottery gets the interest earned at the end of the lottery period from Compound. So obviously the more people who put DAI in, the more interest that can be earned via Compound and the bigger the payout. Now, the reason why it's a no loss lottery is because everyone at the end of the kind of lottery period can withdraw their DAI regardless if they won or lost. So you're literally just, I mean, this is just a perfect way to incentivize people to, you know, besides the smart contract risk, of course, but it's a perfect way to incentivize people to say, hey, you know, put in, you know, all this DAI in here and, you know, you go into the draw to win this pool that grows the more people that put DAI in. So it kind of has that feedback loop there and that viral effect of people saying, hey, you should put DAI in because, yes, it dilutes kind of my, kind of share of the, you know, the pool, whereas my chance to win goes down, but the pool gets larger. So yeah, I'm not sure on the kind of the math behind it or where that kind of equilibrium sets in, but yeah, it's just for me, it's a shining example of like composability within Ethereum and DeFi because of the fact that Pool Together is using these mechanisms that is only achieved by this composability. And they're actually also using an Aragon decentralized organization in the back end to manage different things for Pool Together as well. So just, I mean, it's not just DeFi protocols that can, you know, interoperate with each other. It's also these other protocols like Aragon's decentralized organization platform. So yeah, I mean, really, really cool. Did you participate in this, Eric? I didn't participate in it, but I'm wondering if you did.
So I didn't participate in the first one just because I didn't get around to joining in time, but I plan to pretty much participate in everyone going forward. I don't really see a reason that you wouldn't. I mean, obviously there's contract risk, but like if you're just buying one ticket, like it's not that much really, right? And then you get a chance to win the prize. I mean, genius idea. The idea has actually been around for a while. There's things called prize-linked savings accounts, which are basically the exact same thing just in the traditional finance world. So yeah, this is just a great example of kind of where Ethereum can make things more seamless and better. I mean, obviously like on a prize link savings account, you have to have a middleman and someone's holding those funds and like having to pay it out. It's not autonomous at all. On Ethereum, you can just pull all this together. The smart contract manages it, moves the funds over to DeFi, earns the interest, randomly selects the winner and pays it out. And, you know, no one held those funds in the middle. Obviously, you have this contract risk where, you know, early on, maybe there could be some bugs in there, but as time goes on, that kind of fades, right? But just a really, really cool idea. I mean, not only a cool idea in that someone's just winning money, you know, pretty easily every couple of weeks or whatever it is, but it also brings a lot of liquidity to the DeFi space, right? So now you're people that, you know, if you were sitting on like a couple $100, you probably weren't going to go trying to earn it on Compound. Now, all of a sudden, if you're able to get, you know, 10,000 people together to pool their money and put it out on DeFi, you just created a lot of liquidity, right? So really cool idea in general, but will also help the liquidity side on DeFi as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you were talking about smart contract risk. I think there was a bit of controversy when this was first announced because the smart contracts were actually closed source, so no one knew what was happening in the background. This obviously goes against the ethos of the, you know, the crypto open source community, and it's also a big risk because you couldn't see if there was a backdoor in the contract, of course. You know, even though the team was quite transparent, the team members were known, they weren't anonymous, and, you know, it got a lot of attention from people that you tend to trust within crypto. So I guess the risk wasn't too large, but they ended up actually open sourcing the contracts after the community kind of, you know, outpour, or basically like the community coming together and saying, hey, you know, you'll get a lot more people putting money into this if you open source the contract. So they did that. I guess their main reason for not doing it in the first place was because they didn't want people to copy them. But I mean, that's kind of like, people are going to copy them anyway. Like the contracts themselves, from what I've read, aren't very complex anyway. Like it doesn't actually, you know, take much for someone to reverse engineer this, even if the contracts were closed source. So I think that goes for mostly everything within crypto. I know that, you know, different teams might try to obfuscate their code as well. I know Maker does this with their smart contracts, you know, for competitive reasons, and that's fine. But, you know, it's still open source. People are still able to audit it if they really want to. And at the end of the day, I think any system can be recreated, you know, given enough motivation. So definitely kudos to the team for, you know, open sourcing it in the end and actually not, you know, actually having like a kind of a decent reason. But then once they were kind of told why that reason didn't make much sense, they basically agreed with it and you know, did the right thing. So yeah, great to see that. But yeah, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of these kind of products that tie together all these other DeFi products and make it so that people can win money with zero risk, basically, but outside of smart contract risk, of course.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. The pitchforks came out hard on this one. Like one person was like, oh, it's not open source. Then all of a sudden it's just like this fireball rolling down the hill. Oh, it's not open source. This is bullshit, blah, 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 over and over. I saw an interesting tweet from Nick Johnson on the whole open source thing. It's like you can have your code open, but you don't have to give a license for people to copy it. So if you really wanted to like keep it yourself, now obviously like the code's out there now and theoretically people could probably get around that, but you have the right to choose different licensing, right? And how people can, you know, fork it and use it and stuff like that. So you theoretically could have your open source software open so that people could audit it, but you don't give them the rights to just fork it and go use it themselves. So there are ways around it, and it's cool to see that they did it and up open sourcing it.
Yeah, exactly. I think I saw that tweet from Nick as well. I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't know is that there's different licenses for kind of open source. So, I mean, you can Google it and see all the different types of licenses and things like that. I think there's a whole bunch of them that, you know, have different conditions set to them of what you can do with the code, whether you can like sell it or whatever in a commercial environment, like, all these sorts of things. So, yeah, I definitely have a Google of that if you're interested in that sort of stuff. All right, moving on. So, on-chain activity. Now, this spurred a bit of a discussion even from Vitalik himself. So I think it was yesterday, for the first time since May 2018, the Ethereum network had over 1 million transactions within a 24-hour period. You know, this is obviously quite good because it shows that the network is seeing a lot more use again, following the price rises, of course, it kind of correlates there. But I think that the raw transaction metric isn't the right one to look at. We've spoken about this in the past where, you know, transactions on Ethereum, that could be many different things, right? Because of the fact that we have smart contracts and it's not just a simple kind of ETH transaction or a simple token transaction. Even though a token transaction is a smart contract kind of interaction, technically, you can still consider it like a kind of just a token transfer, right? So I think the better thing to look at is kind of gas usage and what we're seeing with, obviously, the network utilization being at 90% or more. And I've been digging into this a little bit lately myself. There's a few different websites that I use to track this sort of stuff and seeing what's using the most gas. I think I saw the other day the top contract that's using the most gas is one of the Kyber reserves, which actually paints a really nice picture there, because Kyber's actually been growing pretty fast with their integration with a lot of different DeFi products and, you know, different wallets and things like that. So I definitely think that looking at these contract uses is a lot better than just looking at the raw transaction count, you know, for those reasons I outlined. I think Vitalik kind of stipulated the same reasons on Twitter. And I actually went and looked at what the network's currently using, using the gas for. So 50% is being used for raw ETH transfers and raw token transfers as well. And then I think about 25% was being used for token transfers with logic. So basically, an if this, then that logic to a token transfer. So not just a vanilla transaction. And then 25% was used for other calls. So other smart contract calls would include, DeFi apps and, other smart contract apps on the Ethereum blockchain. So I want to see that kind of pie get bigger for the other call section and the token transfers with logic section as well. But obviously, the number one thing for the Ethereum network right now is speculation. A lot of those ETH transfers would just be people trying to arbitrage, especially a token and ETH transfers would just be people trying to arbitrage between exchanges, especially on decentralized exchanges, as the spreads are quite wild on there. And, there's a lot of arbitrage opportunities, a lot of profit opportunities to be made on the spreads there. So I imagine that's what that is for. But it's still great to see that, at least 50% has got to do with some kind of advanced smart contract logic rather than raw transactions.
Yeah, this is something I've been researching and talking about for a long time now. I actually put out a tweet thread back in November about gas, and I noticed this. So basically, like at that time, transactions on the network per day from the peak were down like 50%, but the utilization was up. A simple just Ethereum transfer is the cheapest transaction you can do on the network, and that's 21,000 gas. Around the time of the peak of the last bull, the average transaction was taking like 35,000 gas, and now it's, I looked at this like 4 weeks ago, so it seems to have changed a little bit, but at the time it was up to like 55,000 gas or something like that. So to your point, we're seeing more complex execution on the network, which makes sense, right? Like as dApps are launching and people are using more complex calls and using these applications, that takes more gas than just simple send. So it's funny, I hit retweet on this tweet just because like it was cool, like, okay, a million's like a big milestone, but in the back of my head, I'm like, that's not really the metric that matters. And of course Vitalik jumped in and picked up on it, of course. That's the funny thing though, like as far as network utilization goes, we really can't go higher. Like it's basically bouncing between 90 and 100% every day, and that gap, it kind of just has to do with some inefficiencies in the gas market and creating blocks and miners not wanting to deal with uncles and stuff like that. So we're basically completely full, so we really can't go, we can't really use the network any more than we are now until either layer two solutions come online and start getting used, or we get sharding, right? So in ETH2. So, maybe over the last few weeks, people have just been sending more ETH or ERC20s to and from exchanges, and that's brought down the gas use number a little bit and boosted the transactions. But that's pretty much all that was happening there.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely think that's what it is, because the fact that it coincides with price movements, right? During the bear market, we had a lot of DeFi apps launch, and that's why the average gas use would have been higher. But I think I looked at it and it's actually, the average gas use is definitely trending down at the moment, but that's simply because most of the transactions happening are, ETH and token transfers to do kind of arbitrage, I imagine. I'm curious to see if CoinMetrics does a spotlight on this. They have a brilliant state of the kind of network newsletter that comes out where they look at different on-chain metrics for predominantly Bitcoin and Ethereum. So, if anyone from CoinMetrics is listening, I'd love to see kind of breakdown of what people are using the Ethereum gas for, as you guys have data scientists, and I'm not very good at digging into raw data myself. I just use the tools that are available to me.
Yeah, there's also this really shady looking contract out there that on certain days is taking up like 40% of the network gas. I think it stopped like a week ago, or at least I haven't seen it. It's called like digital or pure gold token or digital gold token. There's no website for it. No one knows what it is, but it's this contract that on certain days is spending thousands of dollars. And over the time, it's spent like $1 million in gas fees. And it like takes a transaction in and then airdrops this token to other ones. And I've seen theories out there that it's some big like money laundering operation or Tumblr or whatever, but I would love to see some more deep dives on that too. I know some of the My Crypto team started to dive into it, but I haven't seen too much detail, but that was playing with the gas numbers a little bit as well.
Yeah, exactly. We're always going to have these kind of funky contracts that do weird stuff. And then when you really dig into it, it starts painting a picture of what's actually going on. But that's obviously what's going to happen with Ethereum, and that's never going to stop because of the permissionless nature of it. I don't think that's kind of a bad thing, especially I think the only negative is that it bloats the kind of blockchain, it bloats the state, but obviously we're going to have state rent implemented eventually. So it'll cost these people more to kind of spam the network, and eventually that'll be flushed out of the network because they'll run out of rent or they'll stop paying the rent. So yeah, I think that it's not a problem, not a big problem going forward, but yeah, I would love to see someone do a kind of deep dive on what, you know, maybe just over the last year or, you know, the last year and a half, what the Ethereum network has actually been used for, you know, what were the top contracts, what were the top calls, smart contract calls and things like that. So, you know, if anyone's listening, please do it. I would love to shill it through the newsletter on the podcast. All right, moving on to the last thing. There is a tweet from Cyrus Unisi this week that really caught my eye. I think Spencer Noon put it best that he says, Cyrus doesn't really spend much time on Twitter, but when he does and kind of peeks his head out, he puts out a great kind of thought around, you know, what's happening within Ethereum especially, and, you know, giving a kind of different take on things. So this week he said, if I thought that ETH could be memed to death by Bitcoiners or other Ethereum killers, I wouldn't stay invested in it. Simple. But ETH will continue to exist as long as devs are attempting to iterate its tech like it always has. Now, he continues for a couple more tweets. You can read them in the newsletter, basically, you know, talking to this point. I think this is a really great point. There's always people talking about, you know, what's going to kill Ethereum, people trying to launch different Ethereum killers and everything like that, right? We've always got this. We battle with this every day, especially Bitcoiners constantly trying to, you know, pull Ethereum down and everything. And then, you know, someone brought up a good point that the best time to kill ETH, I think actually it was Cyrus, yeah, in his third tweet, says the best chance to kill ETH was after the DAO happened, right? I mean, I wasn't around for the DAO, so I'll let you talk to that in a second, Eric. But basically, I believe the same thing, right? The best time to kill ETH was, you know, when it was only a year old. You know, the DAO was a huge thing. The, you know, there was a whole controversy around it. A hard fork happened. We spawned Ethereum Classic out of that. All this kind of mess happened, and ETH's still here. So if ETH can survive that, just like Bitcoin has survived things like, you know, I guess SegWit 2x fork and, you know, even the to an extent the BSV stuff as well. If Bitcoin can survive that, you know, obviously it's very hard to kill Bitcoin. It survived a few things. ETH's going to keep surviving different things as well. I mean, there was other things as well, like the Shanghai DOS attacks too, right? There's all these things that happened, especially before my time. There was the parity frozen funds, of course, that kind of brought back memories of the DAO, and we kind of defeated that for now, I guess. Like, it can always be brought up back in the future, but I don't think it's going to change people's opinion. We're not going to reverse that kind of that thing there. We're not going to rescue the funds for them. But yeah, so I definitely agree with Cyrus here. It was a great point. I think that when we're kind of discussing this stuff with people, and, you know, people saying Ethereum is dead or whatever, I think talking to this point and saying that how is it dead, right? Like, where, you know, that everything's going up, like a usage across the board is going up. Like, it's like, I don't know how to best put it, but it's too far gone now. Like, it's, you good luck killing it, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, and he said in the tweet, the time to kill ETH was definitely at the DAO. And I mean, people tried. They're, you know, Barry Silbert and a lot of Bitcoin maximalists and large Bitcoin investors, you know, people tried to FUD it. And at a time, ETH Classic got up to like 60% of the value of ETH during some crazy pump after it. There's a lot of unknowns. That was definitely the time to kill it. And it didn't happen. So it's just simply not being killed now. I mean, eventually it's inevitable that Ethereum's going to flip Bitcoin someday. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I can guarantee you it's going to happen. And I think people are kind of getting like worn out on the meme wars a little bit. Like, I think people are starting to wake up a little bit to the fact that, you know, a fixed supply just doesn't make sense in the long run if you can't pay for security of the network. You know, Ethereum's just more complex, and we kind of have more complex agreements amongst the community. Like, we didn't just put a hard fork on the number. Like, it's like, well, maybe we should think about this. We should have a little bit of inflation, because how are you going to pay miners? And once we go to proof of stake, you know, you still need to incentivize stakers, but it can be much lower than, like, there's just, to me, more thought. It's a little more complex. And I think in the short term, that hurts Ethereum. I think it's still rather hard to explain it to people that don't know about it. Bitcoin's very easy to just spew the memes like digital gold and it's scarce, like there'll only be 21 million, blah, blah, blah. That works in the short term, but in reality, in the long term, it's just not going to last. I mean, you want to follow the developers and where the community is and, you know, the passionate people and what's being built and where it's being built. And the simple solution is that's just happening on Ethereum. So, you know, Ethereum's doing the long play, I think, and, you know, it could flip Bitcoin next year. It could flip Bitcoin in 15 years. I don't know, but, you know, I want to follow the developers and where the action's happening and where the clear future path is. And that's in Ethereum. And I think Cyrus, you know, sums it up very well in his tweet. And I think people get very caught up in kind of, people attacking Ethereum and these meme wars and narrative wars. But, you know, honestly, I think you and I have done a really good job with ETHUB, and it's why we started with defending these narratives. And people that maybe don't know about Ethereum and are hearing this, they can go to the site or see our tweets or whoever we retweet or people that other really good people out there on Twitter or Reddit or whatnot to just kind of defend these attacks. And I think it's done a lot since the bottom. And I think everything seems to be shaping up since it seemed like Ethereum was under constant attack about being dead once we were down at $100 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I think talking to the point of the flippening, I think it's very important to note that, I mean, I personally believe, and I'm sure you feel the same way, that Ethereum's already flipped Bitcoin literally every metric that matters, and except market cap, right? Market cap obviously matters from, you know, different perspective. It builds a narrative. It lets you kind of shill that you're number one or whatever. But I think that in terms of every other metric that matters, you know, people building on it, developers, companies building on it. We have an enterprise section now on ETHUB. You can go check out all the companies building on it, like Microsoft and Google, and what they're doing and what they're working with. You know, I think that all those metrics, transactions a day, people using it for different things, people actually using it for peer-to-peer cash through DAI and things like that. I think Ethereum's already won, and I don't think it's going to lose. Like, there's so much development, not just ETH2, but ETH1.x. There's so much happening over the next few years that I think even the next kind of decade, right? I think there's no more exciting space to be within crypto than in Ethereum. I think the Bitcoin space, that's why I'm not, I mean, I don't hate Bitcoin, but the reason why I'm not in Bitcoin is because it's just boring to me. Like, I actually don't understand what I would do in Bitcoin besides talk about the price all the time. Like, there are, of course, developments that happen around it. They've got a few different kind of things that they're bringing to Bitcoin to improve the protocol in a few different ways, but it's tiny compared to what's happening on Ethereum. So yeah, I'm just not sure. I mean, for any Bitcoiners that are listening to this podcast, I doubt there's many, but for any that are, DM me on Twitter, and please, I'd love to know what you guys talk about when the price is not going up.
Lightning Network, bro. Duh. Lightning Network. But yeah, no, it's not like the long-term play to me isn't ETH versus Bitcoin, like for multiple reasons. First and foremost, I think Ethereum, like you said, is already flipped on the most important stats, and that'll catch up in the market someday. It's where I think the most interesting things are happening. Bitcoin will stay around. I don't think that's where the long-term battleground is. I think Ethereum at least is well positioned to do that. To me, the battleground is still, you know, if you want to have a bearish sentiment here at all, is will just crypto succeed in general, right? I mean, obviously we think it will. We wouldn't be doing this and working full time in the space and stuff, but that's less of a guarantee to me than will Ethereum in the long run be more important to kind of worldwide adoption than Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people tend to forget that, but that's because the space is still so small, and I don't think we're going to be challenging the kind of world order as it currently is for quite a while. But that is definitely the long-term goal and the long-term kind of battle that we're going to be seeing play out. But for now, we got to fight people and fight people on Twitter. And I think you touched on a good point that the markets will eventually catch up. I was actually reading a Jeff Bezos quote the other day. Now, I hope this quote's accurate because it's what I'm basing a lot of things on, but I've seen it a few times, so I think it is. He basically said that, you know, when Amazon's stock price was kind of down a lot back when Amazon was first started around the year 2000, obviously the dot-com bubble burst and everything, but Amazon's stock price was basically kind of dead, right? A lot of people lost confidence in Amazon. They're like, it's dead, blah, 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 whatever. And I kind of see the same parallels in Ethereum because of the fact that a lot of the, especially the Bitcoin maximalists, have really, really loud voices within the community. They kind of drown out all the positive sentiment that's what's happening on Ethereum. So they've got command of the narrative there. But if you actually dig into it and see what's happening, you kind of see behind the scenes. And this is exactly what Jeff Bezos said. He said, the stock market will eventually reflect the true value of our company because, you know, obviously Jeff and his company, they saw what was going on behind the scenes. They saw how much growth was happening. They saw, how much the site was growing, what they were doing, all their different developments. And that's exactly what we're seeing, right, within Ethereum. We're in Ethereum, so deep in Ethereum that we see everything that happens, essentially. Like, nothing gets past us, really, because we follow all the right people on Twitter, and we're kind of obsessed with it, with Ethereum and keeping track of everything. So I think that eventually, as you said, the market will catch up. We'll see this reflected in the price, especially within kind of the ETH BTC ratio, which has taken a hit lately, which of course leads to negative sentiment around Ethereum, blah, 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 and it kind of spirals from there. But the long game is definitely to wait for the rest of the market to catch up, wait for people to break out of their kind of echo chambers, or help them break out of their echo chambers and show them that, yes, Ethereum is not a scam. It's not dead. There is so much happening that, you know, you're missing out on it. And eventually we're going to see that wave of FOMO come in too, right? People start buying ETH at a really high price compared to what it is now because they're like, oh shit, like I didn't know all this. You know, why didn't I know this? And I think it's simply because, you know, especially on Twitter, as soon as you start a Twitter account, all the suggested accounts under crypto is just Bitcoin maximalist. And they're not just maximalist in the sense that they only like Bitcoin. They also just constantly, you know, shit on Ethereum, constantly call it a scam. Say it's like a shit coin, say that, you know, DeFi is not being used by anyone, that DeFi is a scam, all this kind of stuff, right? You know, when you really think about that from a psychological perspective, that these new people are getting kind of exposed to that, then of course they're going to think it's a scam straight away because they're looking at these people of you know, in positions of authority and taking their word as gospel. It makes it even worse because most things in crypto are scammy or are shit and don't need to exist. So I think that, and it kind of bolsters that argument, right? So I think that we have a very long road ahead of us and a very big fight ahead of us to kind of flip the narrative there. I think we've done a really good job, obviously, as you mentioned, with ETH Hub, and I think the community at large has rallied around that and used it as kind of a way to flip the narrative as well. But it's still a very long path from here.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about perspective too, right? Like it's important to zoom out on the charts and step back a little bit. And, you know, Ethereum launched like not even 5 years ago. I mean, these same people were saying the same thing when Ether was during ICO and Ether was like 30, 40 cents or whatever, right? And look at where we are today. So like I was saying, it's all about the long game. It's important to kind of like get perspective and step back and just kind of focus on what's important. And yeah, the market will eventually catch up. Don't worry too much day to day about, especially don't worry about the flipping ratio, but just price in general, because it just takes time to catch up with fundamentals.
Exactly. Okay, we've gone a bit over time here, a bit of rambling there. So I think we'll cut it there. Thank you everyone for listening. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter or podcast yet, you can do so by going to ethub.substack.com. And that's all for this week. We'll catch you on the next one. See everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast.